Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. You know, there's always these jokes about people loving to bury headlines. You know, the 5 p.m. Friday news dump. Gotta say, it's an all-time news dump to trade Carmelo Anthony while LeBron James is actively taking shots at the president of the United States on Twitter. Scott Perry, I mean, give him full credit. He's supposed to be one of these guys, real by the book, quiet, neat freak. Sam Presti, always been, you know, one of these guys who plays it very close to the vest, is not trying to make, huge waves. That is next level bearing up a story right there, isn't it?
It feels like Melo's whole summer was buried by the news cycle. And then you're right. The Saturday 1 p.m. news dump, although all of Saturday felt like a news dump where it was just like, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. And it was a lot to keep up with. So we decided to move up the pod a little bit to talk OKC, to talk Knicks, to talk Trump versus the NBA, and really all sports at this point. And so there's a lot to get through, but I feel like we should keep it simple and start with the OKC trade that really nobody totally cared about on Saturday because there were bigger things happening in the world. But let's just talk OKC right now. We have a question here, actually.
Well, before we get to that question, though, let's seriously put this into perspective. I mean, the Melo era in New York hyped year after year after year. Hugely disappointing in total when you look back on it. I mean, I think they won one playoff series the entire time he was there. He gets this giant new contract, and immediately when he got that new contract from Phil Jackson, after all the consternation about whether they give it to him or not, and you know his little tour, free agency tour around, whatever you want to call it, the countdown clock was on in terms of when he would be traded. If we went back to when he signed that contract, and I told you, hey, you know, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, he's going to be traded, and no one's even going to care, despite a summer's worth of rumors leading up to it, because it wasn't even the most important thing that happened on that day. It was overshadowed by a beef between the executive branch and the defending champions. I mean, it's surreal. I mean, completely
well,
past
all right. Here's the thing. Here's the
any
thing.
Kind of reality.
If you include President Donald Trump in your hypothetical from 3 years ago, yes, I'd be like, get the hell out of my face. But the funny thing about the Melo deal is that at the time, it wasn't that hard to imagine him just completely falling off a cliff 2 or 3 years down the line. And I think that's what made it so depressing, is that everyone knew exactly how this was going to end. And it just sort of, we had to just watch it like a slow car crash. And now Melo's finally free. I think everyone is better off with Melo not on the Knicks anymore.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think there was one point early on the podcast where I hadn't quite, you know, broken out my cruel knives. I think I said that Carmelo was like a bystander to his own reality, and you almost started crying because you thought such a mean thing for me to say.
It really was. You said Carmelo Anthony is a bystander to his own life, and it's still one of the meaner things that we've said because it's partly true. And I'm curious as to whether your feelings have changed after the trade.
No, they actually, let me take this back. They have. He was a bystander to his own life because he had one image of who he was, and he was desperately clinging to that image. And despite mountains of evidence to the contrary, I think if you go back to that same conversation, we basically said that this is what needed to happen. Like, they had to finagle some way for him to get to sort of an aspiring contender where he could still play meaningful minutes and have a role and, you know, a better fitting job description than trying to be the number one guy on a really pathetic lottery bound team, which was just sad for everybody, especially once you drop the Porzingis factor into it. And now he's like standing in the way of what could be a pretty promising future. And that got really depressing because, you know, he certainly didn't see himself, in that light. So I think this actually winds up pretty, you know, being a pretty good escape hatch. The fact that it only took Enes Kanter and Doug McDermott, who's now been, traded twice in less than a year, is pretty remarkable. And the fact that it didn't require a buyout might be the most impressive part of it. You know, like, I thought this was going to end with a buyout eventually. So, you know, kudos to the Knicks for being able to trade him, even though the package they got back was, you know, pathetic.
Yeah. I mean, I still can't believe that Phil gave him a no trade clause a couple years ago. That is one of the crazier things to happen over the last couple years of free agency. But we've started off too depressing. I feel like there's a depressing Melo angle, and then there's also Melo and OKC. So here, let's talk about OKC's prospects. Justin says, it's hard not to love Melo on OKC, especially considering what they gave up. Glad to see they're all in. It's too bad they weren't this invested in winning when they had Russ, Harden, and KD on the same team. Ain't none of my business, though. The show just keeps getting better. So how real do you think this is for OKC, just in terms of progress up the West pecking order?
Well, I was always a little skeptical of the Russ-George pairing as being a kind of like a game-changing, get them into the top three part of the Western Conference. But they had bigger issues, and the issues were basically all of the other players on the team besides Steven Adams, and I kind of like Robertson. I mean, their depth was abysmal. Their lineup versatility was terrible, and ultimately that's what was going to hold them back. I mean, they were not going to get out of the first round of the playoffs if they hadn't made this trade, because they have one good lineup. I mean, they could play big. You know, Adams in the middle. They can't take him off the court. All of a sudden, you're putting in all these guys who really aren't that good. And even if they could use Patrick Patterson as a center, they were going to have a hole that had to be filled by either McDermott or Alex Abrines or one of these other guys who just has no postseason track record, who, you know, can't be really counted on to play defense and is going to wind up being a big minus. So they were dead enders to me. It almost didn't matter how good George and Russ, kind of how that pairing worked. They didn't have what you really need to win. I'm not saying that Carmelo Anthony is all of those things, you know, just by himself, but he's a lot better at checking some of those boxes that I mentioned than a guy like Enes Kanter, who just can't be on the court, or a guy like Doug McDermott, who just can't be on the court when it gets to May and you're playing against good teams. Melo can be on the court. He has his defensive limitations, but you can use him in a big starting lineup. You can use him in a small ball look. He will raise their overall offensive ceiling. He will improve their spacing. There's going to be a lot of talk about, you know, three stars, one ball. I totally get that. I mean, that is going to be something that they have to work out. It puts a lot of pressure on Westbrook to kind of run this show, but it's a no-brainer trade. Like the emailer. I mean, the emailer is 100% right. You do this trade. Why not?
Yeah, I think it's a why not situation. They don't really have much to lose. I don't know. I mean, I think the boring take here is also the correct way to look at this trade, which is to say that, like, Melo is not as bad as his critics say. He's not as good as the true believers. I don't know if there are Melo believers still, but he's not as good as the hype would have suggested a few years ago. But he makes sense. He gives them another weapon in the playoffs. I just don't think it really moves the needle with the Warriors, and that's really all that matters. Like, it's almost depressing to me how meaningless this is in the grand scheme of things. Like, it should be a bigger deal that Melo, Paul George, and Russ are on the same team, but I don't see them getting more than a game off of Golden State.
Is that how we should look at it, though? I mean, I don't want to go into like a post-winning reality, because, you know me, I'm pretty pro, I'm pretty pro rings, you know, like that really is what matters to me. But like, if you're Oklahoma City, you're not just trying to win a title next year. You're trying to get Russ to sign the extension. You're trying to convince Paul George to keep on fishing in the lakes around Oklahoma City. You're trying to spur attendance to the Banjo Museum. You're trying to sell out the Boot Barn. I mean, you want to keep your local fan base happy, is what I'm trying to say.
You know what? You're right.
Doesn't
this do
that?
You're 100% right. Yeah, this is. I don't think this is going to be enough to make Russ sign the extension, but if it is for some reason, then this is like a massive win for Presti, and he should win Executive of the Year. For pulling off this summer, that is incredible to me. It just, like, even when there were a lot of tweets saying Presti gave up Oladipo, Kanter, and Sabonis for Paul George and Carmelo, as if that was like a miracle, but George is a 9-month rental. Carmelo isn't really like what people imagine when they hear Carmelo Anthony. Like, he's still good, but he's not a all NBA guy, let's say. And Russ could be out the door. So like, I think you're right, though, that we should look at this as an awesome 9-month experiment. And I think there are going to be a lot of nights when it really doesn't work, because Russ and Carmelo are two guys who really need a lot of touches to be effective. And it's going to be interesting to see how they sort of navigate that. And Paul George, who knows what version of Paul George we're going to get? I mean, he, like, the first 6 months of last year, he was pretty disappointing. And then he was incredible over the final, like, 6 weeks of the season. So that, all of that is to say, I think it'll be fun to watch and it'll be cool. And while the Warriors are, like, owning the sport, we really should work hard to enjoy just cool shit that happens in the meantime.
Yeah, I hate that I had to be the one to bring you back to reality to reach that conclusion.
Really did. I mean, appreciate it.
That seems like role reversal. I don't know what's happening here, but a couple thoughts. You were struggling there for just 1 minute about where to kind of call Carmelo. He's halfway washed. He's in the dryer. You need to put in more coins. Okay, he's not quite done. He's just kind of halfway washed. So he still has some game left. He's not Prime Melo. And anyone who thinks he's Prime Melo, delusional.
And that is painful to me because I have been a Melo believer for so many years. And I think that had he been traded a couple years ago, like, and obviously in hindsight, had he signed with the Bulls, it probably would have gotten pretty dark because the Bulls were just headed that direction. But I think a couple years ago, he could have found a situation that utilized his talents a lot more than New York did. And it's painful to me that he's finally getting this shot when you're right. Like, he's at least half washed. And I think the other variable to consider here is whether, like, did he get fat and lazy as a form of Knicks protest, or is that just how he is now? And maybe he'll get in shape and be better than anyone expects.
Yeah. I'm not surprised at all that a bucket getter who failed to realize what winning is all about is, you know, on your sympathy list that you can identify with and you've been apologizing him for. It sounds like, you know,
right
up your alley.
You know who I will always rep for is the guys who are just excellent scorers that
I know
stat nerds will, like, pick apart their game. And Melo, for 6 or 7 years, we've been talking a lot more about his weaknesses than what he does well. And he actually does a lot of things really well. And so the conversation around him has just been out of whack, like, forever.
Yeah, we talk about his weaknesses because he's off and home in April. But look, I think one other point we need to put out there, you know, in terms of why do you make this trade? This is going to get really cynical and dark. You were kind of reflecting on, you know, the possibility of you, and is it going to be somehow enough as a miracle to convince Westbrook to sign the extension? What if the real play here from Presti is not trying to put Westbrook over the top into re-signing, but to completely cover himself in the event that Westbrook does leave? I mean, isn't this the ultimate move for Presti to be like, look, guys, I don't know what more you want me to do. I traded a whole bunch of guys who were worthless for two perennial all-stars to put around our centerpiece guy. I got two of the best scorers at that position to replace the scorer who bailed on us. If that's not enough to keep Westbrook, I don't know what else I reasonably could have done. Hey, I'm doing this from Oklahoma City. Do you know how hard it is to recruit players? Isn't that kind of a compelling argument? I mean, can you blame Presti if Westbrook decides to end up leaving? And by the way, I don't think Westbrook's going to leave. I think he's going to sign the extension. But that would be a cynical read on this, wouldn't it?
I love it. I love that you brought that up because I didn't even realize it until you started talking there. But one of the things that has bugged me about the response to this trade is the people falling over themselves to praise Sam Presti and Clay Bennett, who's going to have to pay like a pretty big luxury tax bill, as doing everything they can to keep OKC competitive and whatever. And look, more power to those guys. They are doing everything they can, but it's perfectly fair to go back and say, look, Sam Presti had KD and Russ and Ibaka. You don't even have to relitigate the Harden trade, but he did a pretty rough job building around those guys. After the Harden trade, they haven't drafted well for years. I mean, they took Mitch McGarry over Rodney Hood, which will piss me off forever. Like, they've just made a lot of really shaky calls. And now going all in on a team that it's probably not going to really matter. Like, maybe a conference finals with the Warriors would be so much fun and would make all this worth it. But it's not. I don't think anybody has any illusions about what OKC is actually going to win this year. And the idea,
well,
like,
one guy does, Paul George, because he came out and told USA Today it feels like a championship team, and he shouldn't have said that, Paul.
I don't know, man. This is going to be the year of, like, just calling bullshit on everything Paul George says. He's in a tough spot because it certainly seems like he's, like, on the Lakers next season already. And so I don't know how you answer questions if you're Paul George at this point.
Well, you don't raise the bar to finals before Hoodie Mello even lands the airport with the Oklahoma City fans waiting for him, you know?
It's September at this point. Everybody can dream right now.
He's probably operating under the assumption that no matter what he says, he won't be half as crazy as Kyrie. So just whatever, let it fly. And that's fine. You know, it is kind of the, you know, why not era of the NBA. I mean, nobody's really catching Golden State. So go ahead and make any trade that you want. And no one's catching Kyrie, coffee shop Kyrie, in terms of the craziness that's going to come out of your mouth. So go ahead and make whatever bold predictions you want. Let's do it.
Yeah, I like the why not era of the NBA. That's one reason to love this trade, is I think if we get to a point where, as a sport, the league just starts turning over quicker than ever, and we get new stars and on new teams every year, I think that's healthy, and I'll enjoy the chaos. So that's one reason to like it.
Hey, can I make a pretty zany prediction that I'm going to get into my sharp mode right now. I'm going to say something that sounds crazy right now, but in 4 months could wind up making me look like a genius. So I'm going to take my 10% shot at that. This is an Andrew Sharp special.
Sure. I love it. I have trademarked that move.
I think the 2018 All-Star Game will not have East and West rosters. I think that they are going to finally, after Melo, I mean, you can't even just like pretend that half-washed Melo is an all-star like they did last year, right? No Jimmy Butler, no Paul George, no Paul Millsap in the Eastern Conference. There's not an abundance of young talent just aching to get onto that roster, and you're going to have 20 solid, maybe even 25 solid all-star candidates in the Western Conference. It's absolutely out of control. I think Silver or whoever is going to come up with some screwy way to get around the conference designation for the All-Star game. I don't think it's going to be like international versus USA. I don't know what it's going to be. I don't think we're going to have East and West All-Star teams this year. I don't know how he's going to do it. That's my prediction. There will be some way where it's more fair. Maybe they can blame it on the fans. They can do another change to the fan vote and let the fans vote it in. But I don't see any way where it's going to be LeBron, you, Candace Buckner, all starting on the Eastern Conference team. I just don't think it's going to happen.
I just want to say the problem with the Eastern Conference All-Stars is not that Paul Millsap is in the Western Conference. But beyond that, I agree with everything you said. I think that's a smart prediction because it's just too ridiculous right now, and it's not worth pretending that both sides are equal. It is, because it is. It's like Giannis, John Wall, LeBron. And then beyond that, nobody is really in that elite. Oh, Kyrie, coffee shop.
Hold on a second, because I'm channeling you here. I want you to channel me. I mean, can't you muster a little bit of anger about a Paul Millsap snub? Because a guy like Markieff Morris is going to get in the East, and Paul Millsap's going to be on the outside looking in on the West. You can't channel a little bit of that for me today?
No, Paul Millsap should never be in the All-Star game. The All-Star game is not an event that celebrates
so
guys who do what he does. And when Paul Millsap, remember a couple years ago when I think there were like four Hawks on the court? That was the low point for the All-Star game. It was not like the 30-point blowout where nobody tried this past year. Like the fucking Hawks almost ruined All-Star weekend by themselves. And I'm glad that we don't have to live in that reality anymore.
You didn't think it was a lower moment when Vivek actually went on the court during the game and grabbed Buddy Hield out of the stands and then just took him with him to Sacramento and left DeMarcus Cousins on the court for the Pelicans? That wasn't a lower moment in All-Star game history?
Oh, man. I forgot about that. I forgot that the rookie game legitimately played a role in swinging the boogie trade.
Well, actually, that feeds into my argument here, though. It's like, what integrity? I mean, I'm the kind of person who would pretend the All-Star game had integrity until recent years. But if a player is getting traded during the All-Star game, just like completely openly,
yeah,
that's pretty much the best argument that there is no integrity for the game. So you might as well get rid of the conference designations. Who cares about the tradition? I mean, that's only the real reason to keep it, right? Is that, you know, going back to like the 50s or whenever, there's always been conference designations. I mean, why not?
Yeah, no, I think that's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I think that would be smart on the league's part, and it's in character for Silver. I think he enjoys tinkering on fans' behalf, and this is one that is actually pretty easy to pull off.
It's really obvious, though, right? I mean, it's so clear cut.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. The West playoffs are going to be so cool. I mean, if we got OKC, Houston, like there are so many different stars on the court, and I don't know who I'd pick in that series at this point. I think OKC is going to be better in the playoffs than they will be in the regular season. Like I, working in Melo, the highest I see them finishing is fourth.
Yeah, I mean, and you're not even discussing like Spurs Jazz. I mean, that could be awesome. You know, there's so many great matchups. And someone should come up with a nickname for the West that, you know, kind of reflects the fact that it's the show. You know, someone should come up with some sort of a designation for that. I don't know.
Look, it's time to move on to the Knicks. We need to talk about the Knicks. We got a question from Jolnir. He says, Melo is gone and so are the ratings. It will be truly great to watch two $17 million centers sit on the bench when the game matters. This is not the end of an era, however, for the end of Steve Mills is here to remain. What do you think about the state of the Knicks right now?
Well, he brings up a good point about the center position. I mean, you could make an argument the best way to rebuild Joakim Noah's confidence is to let him go against Enes Kanter and practice all day. I mean, get a couple easy buckets around the basket. You start feeling good about yourself. Maybe you can translate it against NBA-level competition.
Hold up. Let me jump in here. I think Enes Kanter has taken a lot of slander over the years. And it's fair to say that you're not going to be able to contend for a title if, like, Enes Kanter is a key piece. I think, like, his peak would have been, like, the 20 minutes a game that he was giving OKC 2 years ago in the playoffs. And he actually did pretty well, I think, in that Spurs series before he became unplayable against the Warriors. But I just want to say that the fantasy basketball podcast is coming, and I think we'll probably do it next week, and Ben is just going to have to grin and bear it because he'll be miserable the entire time. And I want to say that Enes Kanter on the New York Knicks is a legitimate factor in fantasy basketball this year, and that's probably the nicest thing anyone has said about Enes Kanter over the last like 4 years of his career.
I'm glad you ended where you did, because I was really worried you were going to take your I always defend the maligned bucket getters take that you had about 5 minutes ago.
No.
And I thought you were about to apply that to Kanter and be like, look, we know he's got some defensive issues, okay, but he can really score the ball. And I was about
to just absolutely melt down. Yeah, he's a bridge too far. I wonder whether pairing him with Porzingis helps hide some of his weaknesses. Like I've seen a couple people throw that out. But I'm not gonna die on the Enes Kanter hill. I think
the best way to hide is 25 minutes a game.
That's like the max Kanter experience you should be having.
The best way to hide his experiences, as Oklahoma City found out, is just to leave him on the bench. I mean, that's the best way to hide.
You were gonna say trade him.
Well, that too. I mean, but hey, he could be an all-star in the East for all we know. So who knows? Look. The Knicks are in dire straits. They have issues up and down, but I want to offer this ray of sunshine to the Knicks fans. You had three goals this summer, three things that absolutely had to happen. You had to get rid of Phil Jackson. You had to not pay Derrick Rose under any circumstances, and you had to trade Carmelo Anthony. Three for three. They kind of nailed it. I mean, if you went back 3-4 months and asked me, would they nail all three of those things, I would say the Knicks will somehow screw this up. There will be some sort of a Dolan intervention here that will find a way to mess up the most important parts. Granted, Tim Hardaway Jr., Enes Kanter, you got some things here that you don't really like. They nailed the big stuff. We got to give the Knicks credit for that.
I enjoy that. It's been a rare glass half full podcast from you, and I like it. I would say I'm still sort of glass half empty on the Knicks because.
Oh, really?
Like you
what,
said,
what makes you be skeptical of the last 25 years of history? Come on.
Really bold stance for me. But no, I can't. The Tim Hardaway thing is so weird. I often forget that they did that. And it's going to be like a wake up call on opening night. And hey, we get Knicks Thunder on opening night. So that's exciting. But Tim Hardaway makes no sense. And it's drafting French Frank over Dennis Smith is tough, man. I don't think that it just like, obviously we're all kind of guessing on what French Frank can be, but it would be so much fun to watch the Knicks go win 30 games with Dennis Smith and Porzingis next year. And it feels like this was their chance to steal someone. And then they could have looked at the draft to like add one more player. And it feels like they're a year behind where they should be right now. And it's just classic Knicks bullshit. And I also don't think it's super healthy to come into this year and be like, yeah, we're going to tank with Porzingis, where at some point some of this losing is going to start to sort of like leave its stink on Porzingis. That's what I'm worried about.
How bad do you think they're going to be? I mean, is worse than Chicago, worse than Brooklyn, worse than Atlanta in play for the Knicks? I mean, you've highlighted the key issue, I think, which is their point guard position. I mean, it's an absolute train wreck, at least for this coming season, for sure. I don't know how you get around that. I mean, I think it's a pretty tough spot when your best guy is, you know, a 7'3" three-point shooting machine and all around offensive stud, but somebody has to set him up.
Somebody needs to get him the ball.
And there's not going to be any real balance around him either. I mean, Hardaway can chuck, but that's really about it. So, I mean, this could be a really, really, really bad team, right? I mean, how bad do you think they can be?
Yeah, well, I do think that they're going to be in the mix for a top five pick. I think like it's hard to pick who's like the tanking favorite. I think the Bulls are probably the leader in the clubhouse to be the most abjectly miserable team in the NBA. And I think the Nets are also, well, I don't know. Maybe the Knicks are currently looking worse than the Nets. But I think like there were a lot of people after the trade praising how New York is now well positioned to tank. They're ignoring the cost that might take on, or like the toll that might take on Porzingis. And I mean, this is a dude who has been hyped as the savior for like 2 or 3 years now. And at some point, now that Melo isn't there, now that Phil isn't there, at some point he's going to start getting blamed for some of this. And maybe it won't be this year, but it just. Yeah. Is not healthy.
I'm going the other way on this one when it comes to Porzingis. I mean, this guy wants to get shots up. You know, I think he's going to love life where he's the number one guy, at least for a year. I mean, I think it's going to get old at some point. They're going to have to be in a better position next year than they are right now. But I think this guy has just sort of been waiting to be the man, waiting to be the franchise, waiting to have the green light, waiting to have the ball in his hands all the time. You know, I think he's got a little bit of that like street ball killer instinct where he wants to be front and center. And that was not possible in the previous iterations of the Knicks. I think he did a fairly good job being sort of like, a team player and patient and kind of waiting and hoping. Phil didn't really have a clear direction for how this was going to work. It didn't seem like they were doing, and really improving in terms of how they were using him. And now it's just like, go do whatever you want. And I think for a lot of guys, honestly, especially guys in their early 20s, I mean, shots are better than wins, right? I mean, I'm not saying that he's like a losing mentality type of player, but like if you had to choose one or the other, what's going to make you like, what's more instant gratification? You know, if you're in his spot, if you can average 26 a game next year, 25 a game, because you have as many shots as you possibly want, if you can be the 7'3" Latvian Devin Booker, there are worse existences, right?
Yeah, look, there are much worse. He could be in Charlotte right now. He could be like in 25 different cities that would make his quality of life a lot lower than it is in New York. I just think he thinks of himself as a superstar, which, it, fair or not, like I think at this point he's probably a little bit overhyped. And you know, I think you underrate how depressing it is to sit through a 20-win season or 25-win season and show up every day. And then the guy they draft next year is going to be 19 years old and 3 years away from being useful. Like,
hey, I'm with you. He's been living that depressing life and not getting the shots. Now he's going back in there saying, it's time to eat. Let's do it. You know, like, that's a better life. I mean, it's he's clearly a winner here of this entire situation. There's no doubt. And I agree with you. Like, the backlash is coming for him, just like the backlash could come for Westbrook, because you can only play the I don't have enough help card for so long. Eventually you get help and you're expected to carry those guys to wins, right? For Porzingis, the honeymoon is just beginning, because everything that's happened previously, not his fault. He's going to be easily their best player this season, and he is going to be able to play the I don't have any help card for almost as long as Melo played it in New York. I mean, Melo was playing that year after year after year until people finally, you know, kind of started pointing the finger back at him. I see where you're going with how this could play out, but I think this is kind of the sweet spot for Porzingis, and he's going to love it.
Okay. Last Knicks question. You brought up Melo at the end. How do you remember his Knicks tenure? I think you mentioned it was a disappointment, but is that how you think of him in New York?
I mean, yeah. Like, the amount of hype. Because the thing with Melo, and maybe I'm showing my age here a little bit, but, like, I remember when it was Melo versus LeBron, who do you draft? Right?
Yeah.
And the idea was not that one was going to ascend to challenge Jordan, and the other was going to try to reinvent himself with a love of cigars and fine watches because he couldn't win enough on the court to stay relevant. You know what
Man,
I mean?
So that's what – it bums me out, because I think really, like, the biggest strike against Melo and what damned him from a national perspective, it's just like he was right there with LeBron as a rookie, and he was so much fun at Syracuse. Like, I haven't been that excited about a young player – more than like three or four times over the last 15 years. He was just awesome. And his first step is great. He's a classic bucket getter. But then you're right. Like, LeBron grows into a player that basically has zero weaknesses. And then Melo just kind of gets a little chubbier and a little more selfish every year, a little lazier on defense. And it was just, it's hard to enjoy him when he had like a doppelganger in LeBron who is just better in every single way. And right up into like that played out in the Eastern Conference playoffs every time with the Knicks for the couple of years that they made it. They would always run into like LeBron, and the difference in what they could do was pretty staggering.
I'll be the first to say it's an unfair comparison. You know, it's like, Andrew, guess what? Like, we're not F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, or like whoever you want to throw out there as like an all-time great. It's like, yeah, I'm pretty disappointing compared to Hemingway. You know, it's pretty tough.
It sucks. Like,
but there's also a sense that Melo did have key decision moments where his career could have gone different directions, and it feels like he whiffed on the decisions in terms of how he orchestrated his departure to New York, his decision not to really team up with anybody, you know, once re-signing, you know, rather than exploring his other options. And I, to be honest, I think Melo is kind of a cautionary tale. When I look at some of these other guys who are on shorter contracts, or they're more eager to spend years in advance, you know, plotting their next move in terms of who they're going to play with, I think they look at Melo getting stuck in New York and they're like, anything but that. You know, like, like, because Melo made it work for himself. Like, he took the endorsement stuff off the court. Like, he really did capitalize on that. He's incredibly famous for, you know, his impact on playoff basketball. It's amazing how famous he is, given that he's just never there late in the season. So it's not like he wasted his life, but in terms of, you know, opportunities at winning, I think guys look at him and say, well, we got to do better than that. Like, we don't want to get stuck on an organization like the Knicks where it's just, you know, pathetic and hopeless year after year after year. I mean, and it got really dark. And it's easy for the ending part to kind of all run together.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys were horrible. And Melo was the one sitting through it. And the fact that he never orchestrated a trade out of there, you know, during those really tough seasons, or kind of found a way to make it work, I kind of hold against him too. You know, it's like, I think he liked New York a little bit more than winning, for my taste.
I think you've been glass half full the entire podcast, and
now
I've been
out
glass half empty. And it's time to reverse the roles. I will remember him. I think his legacy could be as a cautionary tale, but I will remember Olympic Melo and the idea of Melo never quite matching up. It never quite matched up with reality. It never quite played out on the court, but the idea was always so cool that it didn't matter. And when Melo worked, he was so much fun, and like just watching him score was so gorgeous. And I think he got screwed by the LeBron comparisons. He was more like Dirk Nowitzki than LeBron, and Dirk needed a really smart team to put really smart pieces around him, and finally got it and broke through. That just never happened with Melo. And you're right, like, it's 100%, or well, no, it's 50% his fault, and then it's 50% the Knicks' fault. Who, like, I was reading about it this afternoon. Jason Concepcion explained it well. He said, the team is run like a cat chasing a laser pointer, which is a perfect Knicks description. But like half the time they were responding to Melo's own bullshit. And when he like would chase off Jeremy Lin or chase off Mike D'Antoni, the one coach who should have brought out Olympic Melo like in the NBA, but he didn't want to play the four. And so it's tough, but I'll remember the idea of Melo, and I hope that's more of what we'll get in OKC, where he's more of a role player who gets to pick his spots a little bit. And I think it's always interesting with Knicks fans. Like, I think even they are 50-50. Like, if you ask a Knicks fan how they feel about Melo, one guy might tell you, like, I am so sick of watching that dude play basketball. And then there are others who just have a soft spot for him, and I have a soft spot.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but so much of what Phil Jackson said about Melo was completely right. You know,
yeah.
And,
I know.
But there is a whole segment of society who will just like ride for Melo against all those criticisms forever, and just not accept the fact that, like, yeah, there were some pretty big things holding him back. I mean, I have a question for you. I mean, has Hoodie Melo caught up to Olympic Melo as the kind of laziest and most inaccurate portrayal of Carmelo Anthony? Like, I can actually get down with what you were saying earlier about Syracuse Melo. Syracuse Melo was great. And young Nuggets Melo wasn't the worst either. But I'm...
Look, man,
I'm
the idea of Melo
with Hoodie
is a
Melo
powerful thing.
Or Olympics Melo at all.
You're right. You're right that Phil Jackson's arrival was ultimately one of the best things that's ever happened to Carmelo Anthony, because it absolved him of like 3 years of legitimate criticism over the last couple of years. But it's fine. Good luck to Carmelo in Oklahoma City. We both apologize for this depressing appraisal of his game.
Hey, one thing I think we should mention, though, just to close this out. How many times over the last 18 months have you asked me who's going to outlast who in New York, Carmelo Anthony or Phil Jackson? And I mean, Melo outlasted Phil Jackson, but only just, like, only just
Look,
did he do it.
It's a win. It's a win. Put it on the board for Carmelo. It's one of his career highlights. It was a battle of wills, and he won, sort of. Although I think Porzingis won is really the answer to that question, but
I'm telling you, Porzingis is about to eat, man. He's loving it.
I don't know, man. It's going to get fucking dark over the next couple of years in MSG.
Tim
Hardaway is going to be the one eating.
If you think he's aggressive on Instagram now, just wait till he's the number one guy for the Knicks. He's going after all the direct messages.
All right. let's move on to Trump here. So Brett reached out in his best InfoWars sports voice. He said, "Were you surprised by LeBron's choice to speak out against Trump? Don't be. What the mainstream media isn't telling you is that LeBron is just prepping for his post-NBA gubernatorial run." I think LeBron is never going into politics and would not be that great at politics. But I have never loved LeBron more than I did on Saturday around 11 a.m. East Coast time when he checked in out of nowhere with the haymaker to Donald Trump. And it literally made me look down at my phone. I was driving at the time and I was like, "God damn, LeBron." So what do you think? Do you think he's going into politics?
Well, I had an interesting experience with that tweet too, because I was in the middle of doing like five different things and I saw it. And when I read it, I thought he was calling Stephen Curry a bum. And I was like, "Oh no, my day is ruined. Now I got to write about LeBron taking shots at Steph. Here we go." And then I read the rest of the tweet and I was like, "Wow, that took such a turn from where I thought it was going." I don't know about this whole LeBron politics thing. I think he's way too smart for that. I think it takes a certain type of person to go into politics. I'm not sure he's got that personality. I think you could say that LeBron needs constant positive reinforcement, but I don't think it's quite in the same way as politicians seem to.
If we're looking at the banana boat, I think LeBron and Melo are not headed to politics, but D Wade and Chris Paul both have like the combination of charm and ruthlessness that would make for a great politician. So I would bet on like CP3 going into politics before LeBron ever even considers it.
See, the sad thing is, I wonder if you and I are using outdated descriptions of what we think about with politicians, because I'm not seeing a lot of charm in the current cabinet when I'm looking at that squad.
Good point.
And so, I mean, maybe we're still stuck in this Obama mold of like, yeah, I could kind of see D-Wade doing that. I'm not sure. Maybe we don't know what politicians are anymore. But I actually have a different question for you, because I think the more interesting aspect of this whole conversation is kind of what went down with Golden State and with Trump. My question for you is this: let me tell you that we won the podcast finals. We won. And right, traditionally, podcast champions get to go to the White House. How do you respond? What is your first move? What's your first inclination? What do you do?
Me personally, I would not go. We're not famous, so there's not really any value or stakes.
Let's say that somehow there's going to be a photo op. The podcast finalists traditionally have a photo op. So you're invited, you're expected to go shake hands, you're expected to take a picture. What do you do? So you don't want to go. Do you come to me and be like, "Bro, we should not go"? What do you do? Do you like call a meeting and say, "Hey, we got to figure out a way to get out of this"? I mean, honestly, what do you do? What's your first step?
Well, look, my first step is to call you and talk it out. We're a team. I would not make the decision unilaterally. I don't think I would go, because I think that there's real value in saying basically exactly what Steph Curry said. And it was cool to watch him say all that on Friday at Warriors Media Day, because if you watch the video of him on the podium, like, he's sort of searching for the right words. And I think that's something that a lot of people can relate to over the last like 9 months, is trying to explain exactly what they're opposed to, exactly how they feel. And it's hard to do that when you're speaking off the cuff to reporters. And I think he did a really good job saying, "Look, we're trying to send a message that we don't tolerate this from the president," this being what he said, this being what he hasn't said at certain times, this being just like the general lack of humanity, and those are my words, not Steph's, but that comes from the White House right now. And to me, I think there's real value in famous people basically saying, "Fuck off. We don't co-sign this. This is not what we represent." And I do think it's different. what I worry about is that we would get to a place where political differences start to dictate whether teams show up or not. But I don't think that this is about like policy differences. And I think that just the general tone coming from the White House over the last 9 months and the message that they're sending to Americans and to the rest of the world is something that doesn't jive with like with what the Warriors are about.
Okay, next hypothetical for you.
Okay.
Somehow, with our amazing podcast.
I was not prepared for any of this.
No, I know. No, you're doing a great job, though, because I'm going to eventually, I'm setting this up for my takes, but I have one more hypothetical for you. Somehow, we got invited to the Emmys. I don't know if you won. I don't know if I won. Maybe we were just nominated. But there's Sean Spicer, and he did his joke, and there he is backstage, and now you're like 20 feet away from him. Do you go up to get that selfie like a lot of the celebrities do? Do you go spit in his face? Do you walk away? What's your move there?
You know, this is potentially a little controversial considering how angry the internet was about Sean Spicer. I didn't think he was funny at the ESPYs. I've never really been into the like the SNL version of the Trump administration that like goes viral every Monday. I just don't think that stuff is that funny. But I also don't think that he, as an individual, should be treated like a war criminal. And he is not like he's one of the guys. He was so far over his head over the last like 6 months that I kind of felt bad for him. And I think he's just sort of a regular guy who said yes to the wrong job. And so I would not go up and take a selfie with him, but I also would not spit in his face. I think he's just a guy, and he became a target for a lot of angst that's completely reasonable about the like the presidency, but I don't find him I don't think that like making sure keeping him off TV forever is not gonna like really change anything.
All right, that's good takes. I think when I was weighing this, you know, how I would react, my initial just gut sense is that I wouldn't want to be anywhere close to either one of those guys. Like, I don't know if I would spit in Sean Spicer's face. I mean, I'm pretty confident that I wouldn't do that in public, but I think I would bounce quick. I'm not trying to be in any photo with them. I'm not trying to
That's a great point. I would not want to be photographed with Sean Spicer. Like, history is going to remember this shit, and I don't want to be associated with him. That's a fair way to explain it.
I don't even want to be in the background of the photo. And I don't think this is a political statement to say this. I don't like Democrat versus Republican, whatever. I don't want to be photographed with Trump either. I don't want to be within 30 feet of him. You know,
yeah.
I mean, some of the things that he said, I don't want to have anything to do with. I don't want anyone to be able to misconstrue my presence there. And again, it's not just politics. There's a lot of people in the world who I'm just kind of not messing with. And I'm actually going to give myself a little credit here because this is a maturation process. When I was in high school, do you remember Mark Furman, the detective who was like busted for racism during like the O.J. Simpson trial, whatever? So he was
and I'm officially worried about where this is going, but yeah.
Okay. He had a book reading in Portland, like suburban Portland, right? And look, not a lot of famous people come to Portland. So I used to be like kind of in groupie mode at these, like whether it's a lecture, like one time I was behind the scenes to talk like Brooklyn Dodgers baseball with Alan Dershowitz. I just like kind of wiggle my way into these scenarios with like quasi famous people. Because this was like before 9/11, where like security wasn't really a thing. You could just kind of like walk up to famous people at events. So like high school me or middle school me thought it was hilarious to like print out a picture of O.J. Simpson with like the caption "not guilty," fold it over so that it just looked like a blank piece of paper, go to Mark Furman's book reading and have him autograph that so that I could unfold it and it would be like Mark Furman, this like horrible guy, like basically co-signing the fact that O.J. Simpson was not guilty. So I still own that piece of paper. And when I was like 12 years old, I thought it was hilarious. Like, I didn't realize how weird it was for me to be at a book reading with Mark Furman. I didn't really even think twice when he offered me like 5 free copies of his books because no one had bought his book whatsoever.
Not exactly the hottest market.
I was just all in on like, oh, this guy's kind of like, it was the exact situation with some of these celebrities where like, oh, there's Sean Spicer. I'm probably never going to see him again. I better quick take a picture of it because it's so funny. Ha ha. There is nothing funny about Mark Furman. There's nothing funny about Sean Spicer. And there's nothing funny about a lot of the stuff that Donald Trump is saying. And so if I'm the Warriors and I'm in this situation, my first reaction is exactly what Steph Curry and what Kevin Durant and Andre Iguodala and I think a lot of these other guys were thinking is just like, nah, we don't want to go. But here's what here's my bigger point about all of this, though, with the Warriors.
Right.
I think they art of a dealdom. I think they rope-a-doped them. I think they realized they were in a staring match with the President of the United States, and they completely suckered them, and they completely won. Because I think the Warriors looked at this and they said, if we just turn them down outright, we're the bad guys. We're snubbing the president. We're opening ourselves up to charges of anti-patriotism, which, misguided as they might be, I mean, we see them about all these different protests, you know, Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, all this stuff. They get labeled anti-patriotic. And I don't think the Warriors wanted to even have that discussion or be painted with that discussion. However, if they could sucker Trump into not inviting them, then he's the bad guy. He's the one who made the decision. And they're not necessarily victims, but they can claim the moral high ground completely unencumbered. And it's amazing how beautifully it played out exactly like that. All it took was one little statement from Steph Curry at Media Day to load the trap up. Trump falls right into it. Boom. Now we have this major discussion about Trump the person, Trump's statements, Trump's decision, and everyone rallies to Golden State's side, including LeBron James, of all people, who, you know, their biggest rivals in the league, who's able to kind of put basketball aside and make this about bigger than basketball. All things considered, this was pretty beautifully orchestrated by the Warriors, wasn't it? And I'm not going to believe that they just accidentally stumbled into this. I think this was their plan, and I think it worked.
You know, I don't know if it was 100% choreographed, but I think even if you listen to Steve Kerr and Steph talk about it, they, as soon as that went public, they were all kind of waiting for the tweet. So you're probably right, and you're right that it has gone perfectly to plan, if it were a plan. And, I mean, Donald Trump has made the Warriors more popular than they've been in, like, 18 months, which is amazing in itself. To follow up on a couple things you said, I think the reason I said that I'm sort of indifferent to Spicer is that I don't put him in, like, the Mark Furman category. And I don't necessarily associate him with, like, the brains of the White House that we should really be worried about. But I could be wrong on that, and whatever. We spent like 40 minutes talking about Carmelo Anthony, who no one really cares about. We completely buried the lead. Your Mark Furman anecdote in a illustrious history of, like, inexplicable anecdotes on this podcast. Holy shit. That's the stuff that we want on your Instagram. We don't need this nature photography. We need the magnets, and we need your signed picture of not guilty OJ from Mark Furman.
Okay, I hear you. The reason why I asked you how you would handle the Trump thing and the Spicer thing, by the way, was because those are the exact questions that Golden State had to ask themselves, right? And I think it's so touchy, and I think a big part of it, too, is like, even if your main players, guys like Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, they're never going to go. There is no possible way those guys would have gone. You can never convince me that they would have been able to kind of swallow it and go. There's just no way. But I also think that there's a certain level of respect where if somebody in the organization, like, did want to go, like, you know, just was really into presidential history, always had wanted to go to the White House, you know, whatever it might be, it feels hard for me to say that there would be anyone in that room who'd say, like, no, you can't go. You know what I mean? Like, if you're Kerr, let's say one of your assistant coaches is just, like, all about it. Maybe he's even a Republican. Maybe he voted for Trump. Like, he's not out there, like, you know, aggravating the players about it, but he just wanted to go. It's pretty dicey if you're in that group and you're, like, kind of dictating to your fellow colleagues who also were part of a championship winning team, like, you don't get to go and experience this thing that's been happening for years and years and basically always happens, right? So I don't think that they necessarily wanted to be in the position where, you know, they were kind of like fragmenting their group. And that's why I asked you what you would do, because imagine if I wanted to go, like, how awkward is that? Or imagine if you wanted to go and I didn't want to go. That's super awkward. What if our producer wanted to go, like, and we don't want to go? Is he just going to go by himself? Like, it really is a pretty dicey situation, you know?
They had a fine plan. They were going to take a vote. And if it were you and me and our podcast producer, Lou, we would vote, and if it were 2-1, like, the other person would have to just get over it, and it would be fine.
I don't think I would have gone. Like, if you guys both voted to go, there's no way I'm going. I'm just saying, like, good luck. You know, like, send me a postcard. That's what I'm saying.
That's a fine way to handle it. I mean, Tom Brady didn't go to the White House. But you're right. I think it's a
more complicated situation than people think, is what I was trying to get at. And the way they handled it by putting it back into his, you know, kind of like playing the ball back to him and saying, like, you go ahead and make the decision here, it saved them from all of those nitty gritty internal debates, didn't it?
Yeah. No, this worked out great for the Warriors. Again, like, they come out of this looking like the good guys. They are more popular than ever. And I think it's a big win. And as you were talking, I was thinking back, like, a couple months ago, I was talking to somebody whose dad had gone to, like, a luncheon with Trump, and it was in a different country, but they were relaying this to me as if it were a cool thing. And I remember in my head, I was like, that's number one, not very cool. And if I had had the opportunity, I wouldn't want to do that, because I'm just not down with what that guy is about. And, like, I also think that we're going to get 20, 30 years down the line and look back at this as, like, a really dark chapter. And associating with Trump is not going to be a good look in hindsight.
You know what we call those things, though? We call those Mark Furman autographs. You know, it's really not that cool that I have it. You know,
look,
if you think about it, it's not that great.
Don't tell me about it. I don't want to hear about it. I want to see it on your Instagram. You can throw it up as a story. It disappears after 24 hours. The one thing that I do want to do is read this passage from Steve Kerr. He has a great thing up on Sports Illustrated. This is not from the piece that he wrote for us, but this is from his media availability. He says, in general, the idea of going to the White House as part of a championship team is awesome, an incredible honor. You honor the office, the institution. I can speak from personal experience. It doesn't matter. You just set aside personal differences. I've had the pleasure of meeting with Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama. I didn't necessarily agree with all of them, but it was an incredible honor to be in their presence. There was respect for the office and also a respect from not only us, but from the president himself. I think we would, in normal times, very easily be able to set aside political differences, go visit, and have a good time. But these are not ordinary times, probably the most divisive times of my life, I'd guess since Vietnam when I was a kid. Because of the differences in this country, the president made it really, really difficult for us to honor that institution. Our differences in terms of our team and our organization's values are just so dramatically different. I'm talking in terms of inclusion and civil discourse and dignity. It's hard for us every day when we are seeing the things he's saying. I thought yesterday his comments about the NFL players was as bad as anything he's said to this point. It was awful. You're talking about young men who are peacefully protesting police brutality and racism, racial inequality, peacefully protesting hallmarks of our country. Come on. This has been very difficult for us to have to reconcile. And I'm sorry for people who come here for jokes about the NBA, but I read that for two reasons. First of all, I think it's really important to have white people speaking out during all this and about some of these issues, which, like, the concept of fighting racial inequality and fighting excessive force from police officers, like, shouldn't be that controversial, but it sort of is. And I think it really helps to have white allies, and Steve Kerr has been great. And the other thing is, like, as far as the White House and everything else, like, that passage captures exactly how I feel. This is sort of bigger than political differences, but it's It's just like the general disregard for decency and decorum that I think the Warriors find like appalling, and that is tough, man.
Yeah, I'm just gonna add a little levity because that was really poignant, and I can't really beat that. Can we just focus for 1 second on how Steve Kerr has won so much in his life that he's met every single president since Reagan? Are you kidding me?
Look,
how
Steve
does this
Kerr's...
guy win everything?
We don't talk often enough about how awesome Steve Kerr's life has been. Like, he got to hang out with Jordan, got out at the right time, got to hang out with the Spurs. He was on those Jailblazers teams, which is kind of a gift and a curse, but I'm sure he's got some great stories from that era. He's had quite a ride through the years.
No, and he's still going, man. He can coach for another 30 years. I mean, he's going to be in a situation where he could write a book when he's like 90 years old, and he could literally write, I had the opportunity to meet 12 straight presidents, but for moral reasons, my streak got snapped halfway through by Donald Trump. I mean, that is literally something that could happen for him. That is such an absurd level of mastery within a sport. It's amazing. I do want to plug. Let's plug Chris Ballard's piece with Steve Kerr on SI.com. I mean, it builds on the passage that you just read about. It had a great message in terms of trying to bring people together. I hate to be the glasses half empty guy again here to kind of close this out, but I wanted to ask you just kind of final thoughts here. Did Adam Silver do enough with his statement? Because basically his statement was, I was in favor of the Warriors visiting the White House and thought it was a rare opportunity for these players to share their views directly with the president. I'm disappointed that that will not happen. More importantly, I'm proud of our players for taking an active role in their communities and continuing to speak out on critically important issues. I mean, nobody has an issue with the second part of that statement. I mean, he has no doubt been very supportive of, you know, NBA players throughout a lot of tricky political and kind of a lot of times, you know, racially motivated controversies around, you know, around the country. I mean, he's always had the players back there. But yeah, this idea that the Warriors were going to go to the White House and have a rare opportunity to share their views with the president, doesn't that sound a little Pollyanna-ish? Like, I mean, that sounds great in theory. Was there ever even a possibility that there would be a real exchange of ideas about substantive issues between Donald Trump, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Andre Iguodala, or if the Cavaliers had won, LeBron James, you know, J.R. Yeah. Smith, and these guys? I mean, what is Silver talking about? That's not possible. I mean, I would wish for that too. I would wish for a lot of things, you know, like,
yeah,
we could come up with a great list. Like, how many millions of dollars do you want to wish for? I mean, you know, how many cars do you want to wish for? All these just complete absurdities that aren't really possible. How was that ever going to happen? You know? And so shouldn't he take a harder line here? Like, if that's not really realistic, what is he even saying? You know,
I will say this. I will say that I don't share that dream and never really did, because I just, again, you're right, it's not realistic, and it's not how it would have gone had they gone to the White House. But I don't think it's hopelessly naive to think that there is real value in trying to bridge the gap rather than turning your back entirely. And I think that in a different circumstance, it would make sense to go and sort of voice your critique. Like, at the height of the George W. Bush presidency, like, people were very passionate. I was one of them. Like, there were a lot of people, and I'm sorry for we've gotten a little too liberal here, but like, I could see people not going to that White House if it happened today. And, you know, these are really hard questions, and I don't blame the people who think that it matters to show up and respect the office. I just think that Trump has sort of like taken us so far off course that it's out of the question on this one. And as far as their statement, you know, I wouldn't want to be a league trying to navigate the political landscape right now. And
I know,
and
I don't know if Adam Silver wants to be either. That's how this statement read. It's like, well, I am tiptoeing through a minefield, and I'm just gonna let LeBron take this one. That's
the thing, though.
And I don't necessarily blame him for that, but given that like professional athletes here are under a direct attack by the you know, the president of the United States, and I mean, maybe Silver's statement would be different if he had been referring to NBA players with the kind of language that he used to talk about NFL players. But like, to me, Steve Kerr, Curry, LeBron coming hard at Donald Trump. Adam Silver, you know?
Yeah, like, well, that's true, but I also don't think he needed to. I think with LeBron speaking out, with Steve Kerr speaking out, Curry, like, I think this was an opportunity for him to sort of punt here, and there will be other opportunities where more is required, but I wouldn't want to be
a little disappointed. I'm a little disappointed in.
That's fair, but I'm also not looking for Adam Silver to solve like our problems in America. Yeah. That's well, that I problem when people sort of lash out. It's like, I don't give a shit what Adam Silver thinks about Trump. Like, I'm upset and a lot of smart people are upset.
Imagine you're an NBA player though. Did he do enough to get your back? Is him saying, hey, I'm proud of you for speaking your mind, exercising your First Amendment rights, which you have a right to do, you're an American, is that enough to back the players? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's
he has to like slander Donald Trump or like call him you bum. I'm not expecting Silver on Twitter, you know? But like, I don't know. I just, if I'm a player and you've had these good relationships, you know, generally speaking with Silver, and Silver has done a very nice job in the past of threading the needle and kind of managing delicate situations. And he came out hard against Donald Sterling. Hard. I mean, at his throat, the way he handled that. I look at this response and I'm wondering, well, you know, was there more? Was there something else that could have happened? And maybe it's coming. You know, maybe Silver will have, you know, maybe he's just waiting to see how the players actually react. I mean, you know, I think if I'm an NBA player, I'm sort of back where the Clippers were during the Donald Sterling era of like, let's come up with however many protests we can come up with, whether that's, you know, jerseys inside out, warmups inside out, you know, black wristbands. I mean, whatever it possibly is. I mean, I think these guys are very aware and they're realizing that they're making some progress here in this conversation. Like, this has really blown up. I mean, that's the real takeaway for me of this weekend is like, man, there is no avoiding this conversation. This is the dominant conversation. These guys are the ones who have kind of, you know, made that happen. They're not going to give up once preseason starts and the regular season starts. They're going to be taking it to the next level. And I wonder, maybe Silver's just kind of keeping the bullets in the chamber a little bit. Maybe he's feeling like this is not the last battle, you know?
Yeah, you talk about avoiding the conversation and not being able to. How do you feel about it? This is obviously the first time that we've talked about politics since I think Trump was elected. I told you coming in, I want to do 10 minutes and out on Trump. But we've had a good conversation here, so we kept it going. But like, how do you feel about it as far as like sticking to sports?
I listen to a lot of politics podcasts and I read a lot of political stories. I would prefer to only talk hoop ever, you know? Like, I think that you honestly bring up all sorts of nonsense and you drag me down to this level that I shouldn't even be on. I should be up on my high horse talking legacy and talking rings and talking on-court X's and O's and praising Paul Millsap. But no, I get dragged down to these hoodie mellow conversations and does he look thin because he's wearing stripes? I mean, if it was my podcast, I mean, you heard it over the summer. It was pretty darn nerdy.
Yeah.
It was me and Rob Mahoney and Chris Ballard talking writing and talking like X's and O's and strategy. That's how I would do it. And this is why I give you all the credit for this podcast actually being good, because it's somewhat interesting and kind of funny, thanks to you. But I don't live my life by a stick to sports mentality. And I don't think.
Yeah.
Most smart people do, you know.
Well, I'm not saying that, but as a reporter, as a public figure, like, how do you feel about it?
I mean, I think when these guys, these NBA players, protest on opening night, and it's going to happen, that's the story, you know.
Yeah.
Lonzo Ball's NBA debut is going to be a huge story. I will be there, but when these guys have black socks on or their shirts are inside out or whatever it's going to be, that is a story. And I think to pretend that it's not or to not cover it would be kind of dereliction of duty. I wouldn't say that I go around kind of chasing those kinds of stories. But news is news. That's how I look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm about the same in that, like, when it's inescapable, like it has been this weekend, it has to be addressed, and we can do it in a smart way. Like I might write something for Monday about it. I do think that, like, there is some virtue in sticking to sports. Like, the idea that stick to sports is dead, like, that is now worse than stick to sports.
Thank you for saying that. You're just reading my text messages now. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you're right, man. Yes. For the record, Ben came up with that. I just think
that's true, though, because it has, like, it's another classic case where everybody finally rallies around this concept that has been known forever. Stick to sports was never really a thing, you know, and, like, stick to sports is dead. Well, that, you know, as long as politics and race, like, was stick to sports a thing when the Major League Baseball was segregated? I mean, give me a break, you know? It's like, come on, guys. Like, do we really think that today's, or, like, the last 24 hours of events has completely altered American history? Come on. That's so disingenuous, you know?
Well, and also, I consider myself to be fairly intelligent. Obviously, I'm unbearably condescending toward you, like, 10 different times a week. But I also am a little bit more reluctant to sound off on politics because I'm not as much of an expert as smarter people than me. And I'd rather read someone who is an expert in politics, like Ryan Lizza or at the New Yorker, or like any number of guys across the media who are
Sean
fantastic.
Hannity, Alex Jones,
InfoWars Sports. I don't know. I think as far as us, we'll probably tread lightly and weigh in when it's appropriate, but I don't think people, like, we're not going to, like, suddenly start talking about Trump every week. And to me, like, I was super depressed when Trump won, and I wrote about this last year, but, like, the NBA is such a wonderful antidote to everything that Trump represents and Trump's vision for the world. And, like, even as he was fucking going nuts in Alabama on Friday night, there was the next tweet I saw was John Wall at Kentucky, like, giving a really emotional speech about his mom. And so, like, a lot of times I use this podcast and the league itself and the people as just an escape. So I, like, if anyone is listening pissed off that we're talking about politics, I actually kind of get it, but shout out to the league for sort of keeping me sane through all this too.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, you're really tear jerkers today. I'm gonna have to add some more levity by saying it's about time you admitted that you were the condescending one, because I feel like I've been getting attacked left and right lately from our emailers saying that I'm so mean to you and all this and that, and it's like, yeah, I'm just firing back here, okay? Sharp's the one who picks every battle. But I think that's a good place to wrap it, man. That was well said. We're not going to be a politics podcast. It's not going to happen. We got the preseason coming up. We got Media Day coming up. I'm going to Lonzo Ball Media
podcast.
Day, man.
We got the fantasy pod coming.
Oh, yeah. The Enos Kanter Hour. That'll be great. But you're going to Joel Embiid Media Day. I'm going to Lonzo Ball Media Day. What more do the folks want than that, you know?
It's going to be great. I can't wait. Check in with us on openfloormail@gmail.com. We're coming back Friday with a mailbag. And yeah, I have to wake up at 6:30 in the morning tomorrow and drive to Philly. So here we go. You know, the season is here.
All right. I'm going to go dig through my tubs of memorabilia to find this Mark Furman autograph for you.
You owe it to the fans.
Until then, I'll talk to you, man. Take care.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.